that the probation officer has to notify the court within one judicial day. Within 36 hours after that point, the court makes a decision whether or not the person should be released pending the disposition of the probation charge. And the court is given under the bill authority, if it thinks it's appropriate, to cite the probation violator into the court that issued the original probation. If the defendant fails to appear, then it's a failure to appear charge that's brought in the court that issued the original probation. And the bill requires that within 14 days after the person is picked up, that a hearing be held on the underlying charge as to whether or not the probation was violated. The whole purpose of the bill is to provide some time frames for things to get done with respect to probation violators. Each of the deadlines in this bill is waivable. I think the 36-hour requirement is waivable for good cause shown. The 14-day requirement on the probation violation hearing is waivable for good cause shown. All we're trying to do with this bill is to have someone there to make a decision as to whether or not the person ought to be in jail pending disposition of the charge. This bill is endorsed by the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the State Bar Committee on Corrections and Detention, the Association of Oregon Counties, and the League of Oregon Cities. It passed the House unanimously, and we encourage your favorable disposition of the bill.
Okay. Any questions? All right, Paul, thanks.
Mr.
Yes, Council.
Mr. Snyder, this may seem like deja vu for you, but what happens if there is no first appearance hearing within 3 days? The Section 4 provides that if there's no hearing on the violation within 14 days, release is presumed absent good cause. What about if there's no first hearing?
Mr. Chair, Counsel, I'm not sure it requires a hearing. It just requires that the defendant be brought before a magistrate.
All right, well,
to
if
decide.
There's no first appearance, then within the first 3 days.
It does have the exclusion for good cause shown. If, arguendo, the court does not find good cause shown, I suspect the same thing would happen there as currently happens when you fail to bring a defendant on arraignment within 36 hours. The defendant would be released. But this does provide that provision that does not, as I understand it, exist for the 36-hour requirement on arraignment, and that is that you can find good cause under this bill. So if the court finds any appropriate reason for not having brought the defendant within 36 hours before the court can continue to hold the defendant.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right, Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to House Bill 3040. Kit Ayala.
My name is Kit Ayala, and I'm on the advisory board of the Lane County Child Abuse Association. I would like to express my support for House Bill 3040, which expands victims' compensation to include household members, as I feel this is in the best interest of children and child abuse victims. As a member of the advisory board of the Lane County Child Abuse Association, I hear very often from agencies working with children who have been sexually and/or physically abused by members of their own family. This is a sad but very true fact. Children are most often the victims of crime perpetrated by their own family members. I would like to describe a not uncommon situation related to me by the director of a local program in Lane County that works with single-parent, low-income families. A family was referred to this agency for help in providing appropriate role models for two boys whose father had sexually abused their sister, also living in the home. The mother's single parent after having divorced her husband subsequent to the discovery of the sexual abuse. In this family, as is typical, the father was the breadwinner. Mom is now very low income and trying to learn new job skills through voc rehab. Her husband was arrested and convicted. He no longer resides with the family. This family is in desperate need of counseling for all family members, including the child who was sexually abused. Yet services in our county are extremely limited to low-income families who have experienced sexual abuse. This mother has been unable to locate a sexual abuse group either for her daughter or her siblings that is affordable to her. I would remind you that private counseling is costly not only to low-income families, but may very well deplete whatever resources are available to middle-income families. It is unconscionable to encourage children to report episodes of child abuse and then deny them the psychological treatment they so desperately need to resolve the trauma simply because they are household members of the offender. Again, I urge you to move this issue, expanding victims' compensation to include household members, so that House Bill 3040 can be voted on before the end of the 1987 legislative session.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Wires.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it your understanding that this would involve, would the person who'd committed the crime have to be out of the family by the time the award had come? Or?
Pardon? Would you repeat that question?
Yeah. You're saying that that example you gave,
right,
the person who committed the crime was in the family when he did it.
That's correct.
So the way the law is written now, the child couldn't get any money.
Right.
But your example, the person that committed the crime is out of the family, but when you want the money to come from crime victims.
My understanding is that children, you know, whether the perpetrator is in treatment in the home or out of the home, the child still needs compensation in order to receive treatment. So I'm saying in both of those situations, those children would need therapy. This particular one, the member was out of the household at this time.
Thank you. I understand.
All right. Thank you. Jerry Christensen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Christensen. I'm the director of the Crime Victims Program for the Department of Justice. I've submitted written testimony, but would like to just briefly touch on each of the changes House Bill 3040 proposes to make. The Crime Victims Compensation Program was established by the 1977 legislature. The intent of the program is to assist innocent, seriously injured victims of violent crime with their medical expenses, wage loss expenses, and funeral expenses. The amendments proposed by House Bill 3040 will provide more equity in victims' access to benefits and will also conform Oregon's program more closely to programs in 44 other states. The first change would be to reduce the statutory minimum loss from $250 to $100. Today, a crime victim must have a financial loss of $250 to be eligible for compensation. A majority of our claimants do not have personal resources sufficient to cover costs incurred by their victimization. A minimum loss at this level discriminates against certain classes of victims, particularly sexual assault victims, the elderly, and the disabled. Those living on fixed incomes are especially impacted by the minimum loss requirement. Underlying the stated elements of the problem is the basic unfairness of discrimination. Victims whose expenses are slightly over $250 are more of a victim than those victims whose cost is just slightly less than $250. House Bill 3040 would address this need by allowing more fairness and equity in the accessibility of crime victims' compensation by lowering the $250 minimum loss to $100. The second change would delete the exclusion for victims related to or living with the assailant. compensation program currently excludes all victims of family violence from benefits. This blanket exclusion has a devastating impact on innocent children who've been physically or sexually abused by a family member, the innocent victims of spousal abuse, and a growing number of elderly victims who are assaulted by an adult child. In 1982, the President's Task Force on Victims of Crime recommended that compensation programs include family violence victims as beneficiaries. Of the 45 states today with crime victims programs, Oregon is one of two which continue to exclude victims of family violence. House Bill 3040 would enable Oregon's compensation program to address the need of victims of family violence and join 43 other states in recognizing the seriousness of violence in the home. Third change would authorize awards for funeral benefits to any individual who assumes the financial responsibility for a deceased victim's funeral expenses. Today, compensation for funeral benefits may be awarded only if expenses were paid by a dependent relative. Non-dependent relatives of a deceased crime victim are ineligible for benefits to cover costs connected with the burial of the deceased. House Bill 3040 would amend the existing statute to address the financial needs of grieving family members who have acted responsibly to bury a loved one killed in a wrongful death by allowing direct payment of or reimbursement for funeral expenses taken care of by a non-dependent relative. The fourth change would increase the maximum compensation for funeral benefits from $1,000 to $2,000. Since Oregon Crime Victims Compensation Program was established by the 1977 legislature, the cost of funerals has risen. The current award allowed under statute of $1,000 falls short of paying for funeral expenses, which today seem to range from $1,500 to $2,500. House Bill 3040 would increase the existing limit from $1,000 to $2,000, which more adequately reflects the expenses incurred by survivors of homicide victims. The next change would remove the $1,000 limitation on psychiatric or psychological expenses. Today, the statute places a $1,000 limitation on compensation for psychological treatment. The $1,000 limit is within the $10,000 medical limit for an award. The current limit of $1,000 on mental health counseling is inadequate and very discriminatory in comparison to the victims whose injuries are entirely physical. This would allow us to treat the mental injuries with the same degree of seriousness we do the physical injuries. House Bill 3040 would remove the $1,000 limit on the psychological expense while retaining the $10,000 overall limit on medical expenses. The next change would allow for payment of counseling expenses of a victim's family in cases of child sexual abuse or exploitation when treatment is necessary for the victim's recovery. The crime of child sex abuse is a devastating crime which may scar a young child for life. A child may not fully respond to treatment without involving other family members in a counseling program. In order to address the need of early and complete treatment of the child's injuries, the compensation program needs the ability to pay for counseling of the victim and the victim's family. House Bill 3040 would allow a child victim to move closer to full recovery of their injuries by covering the expenses of family counseling when deemed appropriate by the treating professional. The next change would eliminate a statutory deductible of $250. Today, a crime victim is responsible for the first $250 of loss unless the victim can prove a financial hardship exists. This $250 deductible makes the innocent crime victim responsible for a portion of their victimization. House Bill 3040 would eliminate the requirement for any deductible. The next change would stop loss of earnings benefits to any victim during a period of incarceration. The existing statute allows a allows benefits to victims for loss of earnings due to a crime-related injury. On occasion, we've had a victim who may become incarcerated due to an unrelated crime. The program is seeking statutory authority to withhold loss of earnings during that period of incarceration. House Bill 3040 would allow us to stop benefits to the victim during that time period. House Bill 3040 would also clarify the state's right of subrogation in crime victim compensation awards. The statute currently establishes subrogation rights in the event of a civil judgment or a restitution order against an assailant. Frequently, an insurance settlement is reached against a third party who is determined responsible. House Bill 3040 would clarify the state's authority regarding subrogation rights against the assailant or a responsible third party. Finally, the last change proposed by House Bill 3040 would change the program's reporting requirements. Since the inception of the program, the reporting requirement has been annually to the governor and biannually to the legislature. House Bill 3040 would simplify the reporting by conforming the report period to the accounting and budget period. It would also develop consistency between the reporting requirement to the governor and the legislature. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Wires.
How much more money, have you gotten more money through Ways and Means for crime?
We have a federal grant that we expect to cover the claim payments, the anticipated claim payments. And that was addressing the fiscal impact, which I have a copy of, if you'd like.
You, who did you check with on the funeral costs? There's something I hear about from time to time about the cost of funerals. I don't pretend to be an expert on it. It used to be a few years ago that you could, if you made arrangements in advance, you could be buried for the cremated for the cost of the $275 or whatever dollar Social Security benefit. And it costs more if you make the arrangements after. But I thought that you could still have in Oregon a decent and burial for $1,000.
I will say we did not do a lot of research in that area. It's from bills that we have seen come through on claims today where we are able to pay a maximum of $1,000, and most often that does not pay the entire obligation.
The reason I ask is that if there's the history of this program has been the reason that the various limits are there is there's been limited amount of money to cover things, and so you have to choose between one thing and another. And it seemed to me if there's still any limitation on funds, which I assume there's still an impact statement yet. I'd rather see you sharpen your pencil on that than on
I'd be happy
some of the
to
other things you've had to do. Does this bill speak at all to any redefinition of the standard about if a person's conduct contributed to their injury?
It does not, but we are currently looking at rewriting our administrative rule on that very issue.
Because I had a case where a young man came to me in my law practice, and he had to interpret the facts in a way that would be most damaging to him, was in the process of trying to steal a reflecting mirror off a motorcycle. He said that he thought about doing it and changed his mind and was actually walking away from it when he got shot. But let's make it as bad as we can for him, which was he was tinkering around with somebody's motorcycle to try and take the mirror off, a reflecting mirror, and a fellow opened the door of his apartment, stepped out, and according to another witness, just raised up a 38 Magnum and shot this kid and practically blew his leg off right in the groin. And your department denied that claim because he contributed, and I called up to remonstrate about it. there being no attorney fees provided in these cases. Due to my insistence in this committee 10 years ago, I wasn't trying to get an attorney fee, but I was told that due to the shortage of funds, your administrative procedure was to be very strict on that. And I know that the hospital has never recovered, I can't remember, $17,000 or something like that in medical expenses because this claim was denied. And he had surgery for intractable pain. So it's a very sad story. And for what was at worst a petty theft, he received a permanent disability, and the hospital, which treated him without any insurance, didn't get compensated. So for myself, I'd rather see some change made in that than to help people have a $2,000 funeral instead of a $1,000 funeral. That's just
Do I understand you to say
from.
You would like to see the contribution issue expanded more liberally?
Right. And I would, if there has to be a, we have to make choices, which I know we do, I'd rather do that than expand the funeral. If you tell people, which I'm sure you do, we can give you $1,000 for a funeral, and they go to the funeral home, and as always happens at funeral homes, people say, well, you can have this casket or you can have this casket, and people who are filled with grief tend to be a very easy sell. They've got $1,000 and they walk in the door.
Most often, we would not receive an application from a victim until sometime after a funeral, but that could be a consideration.
Marilyn Culp and the people out in the offices know these things. They can tell.
I would be happy to do more research on
it. I'm glad to hear you're looking at that administrative rule, though. And I'd like to talk with counsel after the hearing about the possibility of amendment. Maybe work on that. I wouldn't want people who are shooting it out over a drug deal to be able to get crime victims' money, but I think that I can't be overly critical of you folks for your strict administrative interpretation when we are the ones that appropriate the money. I'm not trying to get you here and make you look like a bad person. That's sort of my concern. You think you can afford all of these things you're asking for without having to cut down in some other area? Is that right?
We expect to.
Because you think you're going to get money from the federal government.
Right. We currently have a grant from the federal government under the Victims of Crime Act of 1984, and our application is pending for our second year funding.
What would happen if that money didn't come and we approved these things? What would you then take money away from?
That's a good question. We don't have any reason to believe that second year funding will not be there.
Thank you.
Senator Hamby.
Briefly, help me remember, what is the time period that one must apply for assistance from the fund following the act of victimization?
There's a six-month filing requirement, and that requirement can be waived for good cause up to a period of 1 year from the time of the crime.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Sina, are you employed by the Attorney General?
Yes, I am.
And your office is over in the Justice Building?
We're actually in the Annex Building on Cottage Street.
Okay, and are you're on the you're a part actually a part of the staff of the Attorney General rather than a separate agency?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's go to House Concurrent Resolution 10 and Craig DeMoe. Am I pronouncing that right? All right, come on up. I just wanted to look over and see what you.
Try to keep this brief. For the record, my name is Craig DeMoe. Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I represent Oregon Association of Evangelicals and Greater Portland Association of Evangelicals. The resolution deals with the U.S. Constitution and the celebration of the bicentennial. Of course, the organizations I represent have a great appreciation for the U.S. Constitution because of the freedom of religious expression it guarantees us. However, my appearance in support of HCR 10 would transcend the interest of these organizations to a common interest I think we all have. I appear also because I had a hand in the drafting of the resolution. Among all else being considered at this session, I and many others felt that during this bicentennial year, it would be appropriate for this legislative assembly to become involved in paying tribute to the founders and the document that has become the bedrock of our civilization. Therefore, you see this resolution which Representative Minnis has introduced. The intent of the bill is clear. The veneration of the principles contained in the U.S. Constitution is something that Americans of all political persuasions, all faiths, and all backgrounds have the opportunity to agree upon. However, far too little, in my estimation, is said about the U.S. Constitution. And this is perhaps the main reason for HCR 10. The resolution makes an appeal for constitutional education, and we have a unique opportunity with the bicentennial to be involved in just that. I applaud the efforts of others who are valiantly addressing the subject of the Constitution in their own ways. There is another bill that requires a state program of law education with reference to the Constitution. Getting the education system involved in this area is very meaningful, in my view, and HCR 10 also makes reference to that. I've been in contact with the Governor's Office and the Office of the Chairman of the Governor's Commission on the Bicentennial to learn about the roles they will play in the celebration of the bicentennial. I also learned by writing to the U.S. Commission on the Bicentennial that there are packets available to any community who desires to know more about ideas for celebrating the bicentennial. And I would respectfully suggest that you take the lead in making these materials available to the communities you represent. HCR 10 gives the 64th Oregon Legislature an opportunity to make its own statement encouraging bicentennial activities in local communities. I was pleased with the vote in the House on HCR 10 on May 18th. The bill passed without a dissenting vote. I urge the same for the Senate. The bill makes no appropriations. It requires no mandates. What it does is make an important endorsement and sets an example for Oregonians to follow. So I encourage swift passage of the resolution. Are there any questions?
Yes, I, committee members. I'm just curious now. I think I certainly do commend you for bringing to the legislature's attention the importance of the United States Constitution. Sometimes we take things for granted, even in the legislature. On line 12 of the resolution, lines 12, 13, and 14, I wonder if you could tell me what part of the Constitution you had in mind in setting forth that language there.
Well, as I see it, the Constitution is written to restrict the federal government, and thereby we have our liberties. I was not really making reference to a particular clause so much as an underlying assumption that went into the drafting of the document.
All right. Now, is there anything in the First Amendment that you would, you personally feel should be changed in any way?
No.
Okay. You're well aware, I'm sure, of the controversy that has existed over the interpretation of that clause of the First Amendment relating to freedom of religion.
Yes.
As far as you personally are concerned, I take it that you have no quarrel with either that clause or the way it's been construed by the United States Supreme Court?
Well, this resolution was not designed to get involved in debate about varying interpretations of the document itself. And I'm not putting your question off. I just am not sure if that's your main.
Well, all right. Here, I mean, I'm to some extent, I'm I'm taking advantage of you because of your interest in doing this, and your, you know, your apparent, I would gather, your apparent reverence for the Constitution, and so when I find a person who has the kind of awareness you do, I like to ask that person if you are satisfied with the with the well, we're talking about the freedom of religion, which is one of the three basic freedoms that are outlined in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights: freedom, press, yes, assembly. And I was just kind of curious to know whether you have any quarrel with any part of that.
No, the first two phrases, of course, of the First Amendment make reference to religion, and I would give equal weight to both. I think that some interpretations have given more weight to one phrase rather than the other, and the opening word in the First Amendment is Congress, and given that, I have no qualms with the First Amendment at all.
Go ahead, Senator Hemming.
I wrongly assumed that you were going to strongly object to the witness regarding all the whereas language.
Well, somehow, that's the style around here. It dates back 200 years itself, if not
yes,
longer.
It does.
I suppose, and of course, for the benefit of so let me just call your names here now, and if let's find out if there's someone here who hasn't yet testified. So when I call your name, if you didn't testify yet, just let me know. Bonnie DePerry. You have not. Are you Bonnie? Okay. And Alice Myotke. Yeah, you have. I recognize you. Thank you. And Carolyn Mackey. I believe you were here, weren't you? Oh, you weren't here. All right. Olga Gasper. Thank you. And I think your husband was here too, and he's here again today. All right. Okay. And Linda Duman. Okay. And Suzanne Bryant. You did. You say Miss Bryant, didn't you? I'm sorry. Yeah, I thought you did. Okay. Thank you. All right. Bonnie DePerry, then come on up, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, senators, I urge you to support...
Tell us here for the record your name and where you live, will you please?
Sorry. My name is Bonnie DePerry. I live in Portland, Multnomah County. And I urge you to support SB 364 and give it a work session very soon. Every child in this state is a potential child pornography victim, and there is virtually nothing the state law enforcement can do about that. To simply say, I am personally opposed to child pornography, then deliberately refuse to help fight it, is pretty meaningless. And besides that, the constitutional arguments to say this bill is unconstitutional, the testimony that we've already had before has proven that this is just, that argument is ludicrous. The laws that oppose child pornography, even laws that oppose adult pornography, have passed constitutional muster over and over again. Laws prohibiting the possession of child pornography have not had any constitutional problems in any state, anywhere in this country. And so I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Perry? All right, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Carolyn Mackey, please. Carolyn Mackey?
G. Chairman Fry, members of the committee. I'm Carolyn Mackey from Boring, Oregon, Clackamas County. And I'm not very prepared today because I didn't have much time just to get here. As a parent of children and a foster parent for many years, and one who is trying to see or has seen the effects of pornography on children and men and women and families alike, I would too urge you to vote in favor of this bill, 364. There are a lot of people in Multnomah County and Clackamas County that I know who are watching this bill and have been and will continue to. They know your positions on the bill and will be holding you accountable for what happens in this session of the bill. And I would just really urge you to, for the sake of the children, our children, and everybody's children in Oregon, to vote for this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Linda Duman, please.
Okay, Linda Duman from Sci, Oregon. I'm a clerk administrator of Linn County School District number 124 and a certified mathematics teacher is grade 7 through 12. I think at the last public hearing on Senate Bill 364, there was enough professional testimony to prove the need for this bill. It is obvious that with each pornographic picture of a child, and as a mother and educator, I would say that's anyone 18 and under, there is a victim and continues to be a victim as long as this picture is circulated. If the Oregon Child Protection Task Force, and that's made up of some state police, feel this legislation is necessary, then I don't see how any legislator could be against it. Father Ritter, a nationally known advocate against child pornography, has urged states to pass child pornography bills for years, and many states have, including Washington State. And I don't see why Oregon can't join the fight to protect our children. It is against the federal government to mail pictures of child pornography. Child pornography is an evil that must be stopped. The legislature has passed a bill which gives stricter penalties to sexual child abusers, but these abusers must be convicted before the penalties mean a thing. Today I heard testimony that said there are many children are victims of child abuse in their own families. We have a segment of our society that does this, but it's pretty bad whenever you've got good parents, parents that are trying hard to raise their children, and then at the local daycare center or the local babysitter can take child pornographic pictures of them and distribute it.
That's against the law, you know.
I know it's against the law, but it's hard to catch them. If there wasn't money in these pictures, they wouldn't be doing it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for being here. By the way, oh yes, I do have a question for you. Do you happen to, have you seen a copy of the child pornography law that this committee drafted in the last session that's on the books now?
From last session?
Yes.
No.
Okay. Now, I wonder among all the folks that signed up, I'm going to have the staff go in and run you off a copy of the current child pornography law that this committee passed in the last session. So if you'd raise your hand and give me an idea how many copies I need to have done. Who would like to see a copy of that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, all of you that want a copy, we'll give you one now. Where's my, have I got any helpers around here? Somebody can go. Go make 10 or 12 copies, will you, of the sections from chapter 163 and bring them in. And yeah, Senator Hill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask a witness a question. Not too long ago, wasn't there an incident in SIO involving the subject
Yes.
Child pornography.
Yes.
Can you tell us, were there any charges brought against the individuals that were accused?
No. Because the state police said that you had to find the picture. And that's virtually impossible. If you're making money on child pornography, the picture leaves the area.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you for being here. Now, here's the way I'm going to proceed from this point. Everybody else has testified on this bill. I've got 11 more bills that are on the agenda here. I want to hear from Senator Simmons. I want to hear from counsel on a couple of points that counsel wanted the committee's attention directed to. And then I'm going to have to turn the committee's attention to the bills that are on for work session. And then if we have time and the committee's inclined to stay here, we'll come back to 364. Senator Simmons, why don't you come on up here, if you would, a minute. All right. Now, I'll tell you what, Senator Simmons. Go ahead, Senator.
Can I bring...
Indeed, bring anybody you'd like.
A couple of attorneys up.
Sure. I'm just... Senator Simmons and I have been discussing some possibilities with Senate Bill 364 that I want, we discussed it kind of earlier today at the business committee meeting, and I wanted to bring the committee members kind of up to date on that, and then I wanted counsel to speak to the committee members at this point. And I haven't spoken to Senator Simmons since earlier this afternoon, so I just kind of wanted you to tell the committee where you are at the present time, if you would, on this.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jim Simmons, State Senator from Washington County. Following our conversation regarding a couple of alternative ways to make the bill more palatable to all concerned, I've checked with Steve Pfeiffer from the Attorney General's office and Keith Meisenheimer from the Multnomah County District Attorney's office, and have gone over the suggestion you made in very rough form originally and the one that Mr. Kramer produced, and then the changes that I proposed to you somewhat informally. And our consensus seems to be that if the possession of child pornography is the key that seems to unlock the roadblock to getting something done, that we could delete Section 6 of the bill and parts of lines 31 and 32 on page 3, the mention of possession over there. We feel that the rest of the bill is important because it does bring in a new set of definitions which greatly expand 163-665, and Section 4 of the bill, which makes it a crime to deal in child pornography, Section 5, which makes transporting much easier to prove, and easier situation to prosecute than the current law. And then there are a couple of other provisions in the back of the bill which call for reporting, making it a crime to fail to report in Section 8, producing and processing of a photograph by a commercial or other person who's doing this processing, which would help to slow down the production of it. And then...
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Senator Wires.
What section were you testifying
to?
Eight.
Yeah.
You're saying that that's a good section for the bill, to keep in the bill?
Yes. A person commits the crime of failure to report child pornography if, in the course of processing or producing, he has reasonable cause to believe that the photograph is of a person under 18. And Section 9 is a forfeiture bill, which forfeits not only the pornographic material itself, but raw materials, equipment, and so forth used to produce it, and conveyances used to transport it. That was one of the bills Senator Hamby introduced, which covered the same forfeiture provision. We feel that the bill, which is modeled somewhat after Washington State's law, which is now being tested in their Supreme Court, would provide adequate protection for children by making it possible for police agencies to make arrests and for prosecutors to effectively prosecute and still be within the limits of the Oregon and the U.S. Constitution. And if you have any question to me, or more properly maybe to Mr. Pfeiffer or Mr. Meisenheimer, we collectively would be glad to answer.
All right, fine. I would understand, Senator Simmons, that you're willing to have the committee take a look at Senate Bill 364 in terms of measuring it against the current provisions of the Oregon Constitution. And apparently Mr. Meisenheimer, Mr. Pfeiffer would have something to say on that to us.
I think they agree that 364 would meet the requirements of the Constitution. They can speak for themselves.
With the omissions that you've indicated there?
There's some question even without the omission, but with it, I think, very certainly.
Well, listen, I want to get this on the record straight once and for all, if I could. Does anyone out there, any one of the three of you, disagree with the proposition that 364 in its present form violates the Oregon Constitution? Anybody disagree with that statement?
I'll let the legal experts...
That's the question. So
my previous testimony was, and I stand by it, that unless SJR 18 is passed and becomes effective and amends the Constitution, there are serious problems with this bill.
All right. Well,
I've always tied my seal of approval of this bill with SJR 18.
I just wanted to make sure now that there hadn't been some change in position on that.
No.
Okay, fine. All right, now, yes.
And with the proposed amendments, yeah.
I'll concur with that.
Pardon? Okay, fine. That's Keith Meisenheimer from the Multnomah County DA's office. That's all right.
Thank you.
Now, I tell you what, I think before you leave the witness stand, gentlemen, I think I would ask counsel to tell the committee what he has done since our last hearing on this bill to kind of bring you up to date. And I don't know, I think, Senator Simmons, have you had the benefit of Mr. Kramer's latest memorandum on this?
Well, is that the one you gave me in the
Senator Wires.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a little falling just one step behind here. On page 3, I heard there were two lines that would be deleted. Did I hear that right, or what?
The part of two lines, the part of line 31 in page 3 that follows the word act, which deletes our possession of child pornography under Section 6 of this 1987 Act.
So you delete from the word act to the end of the sentence?
Correct. And then that would require an or on line 30 between act and transporting. Mm-hmm.
So you delete that and you delete Section...
6.
And is that those two the only changes you're proposing at this point?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, may we ask the previous witness, with the deletions of Section 6 and the lines that we just spoke to Senator Simmons about, his feelings then about the constitutionality of the bill, with or without the constitutional amendment?
Go ahead. Do you want to ask the question?
Please.
Taking the possession element out entirely, that's your question, Senator. My testimony has been, and I continue to hold this belief, that it would create problems if the Oregon Supreme Court's ruling in State versus Henry is read in its broadest form. That is, when the Oregon Supreme Court says that you cannot regulate they talk about possession, but among other things, the distribution of printed material, regardless of how repulsive or obscene it may be, that if that's given literal interpretation, then it would legalize or constitutionalize the distribution of child pornography. I think an argument can be made that the Oregon Supreme Court wouldn't go that far, given a child pornography case, but my testimony would be it does create a constitutional problem that would have to be dealt with.
Senator Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, Senator Simmons, you mentioned the Washington statute and a Supreme Court case or challenge. I'm sorry, was that the U.S. Supreme Court?
No, sir. That was, Senator Hill, Mr. Chairman, that was a case brought under a Washington law very similar to this, which is in the Washington State Supreme Court.
Oh, it's there now.
I had conversations with one of the justices about 3 weeks ago, and the case was going to be heard within a week of that time. There's been no opinion handed down yet.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead, Senator.
I assume it was went to an appeals court before it went up to the Supreme Court. Could you or counsel tell what was the appeals court determination?
My understanding is that the appeals court upheld the law, and it was then appealed to the Supreme Court.
That's my understanding as well.
Yes, Senator Brock.
Thank you.
If I could add one thing,
please
Senator,
do.
That has to do with the possession element of the statute, the pure possession. Similar statutes are in effect in several other states, Illinois and Ohio, for example, involving that possession element. That's what's at issue in the Washington Supreme Court.
Yes,
thank
Senator
you.
Brockman.
Thank
I think
you.
That answered my question. I was going to say, is the issue in that case something that we are talking about taking out of this bill?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Counsel.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I
Senator
apologize. Henry. One final question, because Senator Hill earlier questioned a witness regarding the Sio case, which I have not been briefed on, but regarding the law enforcement's response that there were no pictures found. Will 364 speak to that issue? No.
Maybe I misunderstood you. Could you say that again?
A moment ago, Senator Hill questioned a witness regarding a recent case in Sio. Senator Hill asked the witness what happened regarding prosecution.
I wasn't
that
here
case.
For that question. I'm sorry.
And the response was they were unable to prosecute because, according to state enforcement personnel, they were unable to find a picture. Will Senate Bill 384, in its current language, assist in any way a similar case?
Sure, I understand what all the facts were in that.
Chairman Fry.
I'm not familiar with the case or what.
Senator Hamby, the question that might have arisen out of that case would sound like one of evidence. In other words, the bill, Senate Bill 364, one would have to ask, could you successfully prosecute somebody without the evidence in the form of a picture? And as you look at it, I suppose it's possible to conceive of circumstances where somebody's description of what somebody possessed was so persuasive that you don't have to have the picture itself. I mean, it's not like a best evidence rule. So I suppose it's conceivable to prosecute somebody without having the picture itself. But it's hard to imagine circumstances where you'd have enough proof without it.
It'd be very difficult, I'd agree.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hamby, I only know from hearsay what happened there, but my understanding is that the district attorney and the sheriff's office felt that because of the tender age of the children involved, and these were children from 3 or 4 years old up, that their testimony could not be adequate enough to provide an arrest. The pictures apparently were sent out, and these, I understand, were primarily videotape pictures, and that, again, there was no way to get them. Now, whether this bill would have, I think, in talking to one of the officers who did the investigating, had possession been illegal, then they would have had sufficient evidence based upon the children's statement that pictures were, in fact, made, that they could have possibly gotten a search warrant to go to the home and look for pictures.
They did not in this case
obtain search warrants? They did not because the pictures would not, possession of the pictures would not have been illegal. And the bill would not help that.
Would not help that. I guess that's what I wanted on the record, hopefully, so that some in the audience do not see 364 as a panacea for such cases.
Taking the possession out would eliminate that aspect of it, of course.
As long as Mr. Meisenheimer, you weren't here at the earlier hearing, were you?
That's correct, sir.
Are you the one in the office that would be handling such a case if it came in or not?
Not presently. I'm in the supervising the juvenile section of our office.
Yeah, I realize that. And last time, we had somebody else here who wasn't in charge either. He was telling us about what he had heard from some other deputy. But my question is, I don't know that you can answer it any better than he could. Have there been any attempts to put a case together under the present provisions of the child pornography law that you have personal knowledge of? We had testimony from the federal prosecutor's office in Portland that the federal people have been prosecuting based upon the interception or the discovery of these materials, but apparently there was, I don't know if there was no prosecution or couldn't be a successful one. I can't recall how that went, but do you have any knowledge of that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I don't know in Multnomah County of a case where the lack of a prohibition against the possession of child pornography made the difference. But I think the concern that we always have is that, at least under existing statutes, establishing probable cause, where you know that somebody's in possession of the material, but establishing probable cause that their possession is from an illegal means, in other words, it was transported illegally or produced illegally in Oregon, that part of the probable cause is what's awfully difficult to establish, so that the existing statutes do not provide a very strong enforcement tool in terms of getting search warrants.
I guess the question is, I do know that we had input from your office through somebody in the last session when we were drafting this bill, and we did spend a lot of time on it, and I've forgotten who that was, but I guess my question is, do you know or have you heard of an actual case that failed because of some deficiency in the current statute? I know what the theory is of wanting, you know, some additional factors in there.
I've discussed that with Trooper Erickson, and I believe if he hasn't testified, I would have assumed he had, that he has encountered situations where he was not able to as aggressively pursue the investigation as he would need to because of the inability to get the search warrant. So, but I can't say that we have specifically in the District Attorney's Office in Multnomah County had a case that failed for lack of this, but neither can I say that we have not.
Well, I guess that's that's pretty important. At least so far, I understand what the theory is of making these changes, because you know it might facilitate search warrants or arrests or prosecutions. I guess I've always been curious to know whether there was actually one that kind of you couldn't do anything about or fell through the cracks because of the present wording of the statute.
But I think that's a legitimate question, Senator. The observation I'd make, though, in regards to the potential constitutionality is that where the sections are severable, I suppose I'd urge that the committee be somewhat aggressive in terms of making a strong law and letting the courts determine whether that's constitutional. In the debate with Mr. Armstrong from ACLU last time, the reason that was identified for being concerned about the constitutionality is that somehow child pornography may communicate an idea and that we can't make ideas unlawful. And I guess I'd put the question this way. What is there in the picture of a man raping a 5-year-old girl that communicates an idea worthy of constitutional protection? And I suspect if the question is phrased that way, we may be talking about some different standards for pornography with respect to children than would apply to adults. And I'm hopeful that when, as Mr. Pfeiffer said earlier, they haven't dealt with a child pornography case, and I suspect we would see different standards. So I would like to see, frankly, I'd like to see possession in there, even if it has potential constitutional problems, because until they rule, I don't think we know. And I think it is a legitimate and needed tool to not only to go after child pornography, but our experience is, as I understand it, that frequently when you find somebody in possession of child pornography and can execute a search warrant, you will find photographs that lead to victims, that that person is currently or has recently victimized children. And for that reason, I think it's also a child protection issue.
Let me ask you this, then. Do you know of a case where this material has been found and you were thereby led to a child abuse case?
In my contacts with Sergeant Wallacher, he's now a sergeant with the Portland Police Bureau, but in the last session he was with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office and part of their sex crimes unit. He advised me that he had, in fact, discovered more than one child molester through photographs, through search warrants. So I do believe that occurs, and I don't think his experience is unique.
Mr. Chairman, I know a case, State versus Britain, out of Linn County, in which the material was discovered in Montana and led to an actual series of sex abuse prosecutions in Linn County.
And that was a successful one, too, wasn't it?
Not yet. It's on state's appeal because there was suppression of some evidence, but the prosecution is still pending.
Yeah, well, okay. Oh, that's a different one than I was thinking of. Is that on an evidentiary question, or is that on the statute, or?
Well, the search was conducted by a landlord and involved the police taking part, so it's a search and seizure.